Welcome to At a Crossroads with a Naked Podcaster. I am your host, Jen Taylor. I'm really excited. And sometimes when we have tech difficulties, it makes me realize that I want to do this podcast even more because Cassie and I have had to reschedule and we've had some tech difficulties. So this is a message that definitely needs to be heard. I'd like to welcome Cassie Christopher. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
I am ecstatic about this. So we're going to jump into CassieChristopher.net. Everything will be in the show notes. So every way to get in touch with you will be there, but it's CassieChristopher.net. And I want you to just dive in to the website and we can talk about everything that's there.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So I am a registered dietitian. I think that's helpful to know what I do and who I help going into it, who the website is for. I'm a registered dietitian who helps women 45 and up in the peri and postmenopausal stages heal emotional eating and body image. I'm a body positive registered dietitian, which means I'm not obsessed about weight loss. I can help people do that if that's what they're looking for. But I don't necessarily believe that weight loss is the only path towards health, which I like to put that out there as well. So my website, you know, starts out with a picture of me, hopefully looking welcoming and explaining who I am and who I do it for. And then I actually recently cut a lot from that homepage because what I'm trying to do is just get people to my blog. So that blog comes up right underneath. I've been focusing on that quite a bit. And those blog posts help people understand whether they are emotional eaters. That's actually a really common question that I get. And even my clients will say, oh, I didn't really know I was an emotional eater until I met you. Cause I think emotional eating often masquerades as a lot of other issues. So a lot of those blog posts are centered on helping people figure out if they even have the problem that I help people solve and then understand what the solution entails.
I love that. Well, yes, your pictures are great. I think you're absolutely adorable. There's a couple of things. One thing is you have a compassionate clarity call. So I want you to go over that. And I love to brag. So I want you to go over some of the as featured in, because you've got some pretty big names here. And I love to understand the connection between you and what you do and who's featuring you, which is really incredible. And I love that you shared the letters after your name, because it does give clarity on what you're doing. And you're very clear about who you work with and what you're working on. So there's no confusion about that.
Yeah. Yep. For sure. Yeah. The letters after my name. Yeah. That's important to me to help people understand that I didn't do a, 12-week health coaching online thing and then call myself an expert in emotional eating. Like, I have my master's degree in nutrition. I'm a registered dietitian, which means I've done, practical experience, taken the hardest, most stressful test of my life, as these things often are. And so I really can understand the science behind what is happening. But where I differ from a traditional dietitian is that I actually have the personal experience with emotional eating, which I know that we'll get into in a moment. You asked about the as featured, and then I'll talk about that compassionate clarity call. I have just been so blessed and really enjoyed collaborating with different podcast hosts, different media outlets. I've had a lot of fun getting to know some reporters through the Help a Reporter Out. If anyone's heard of that, Harrow, you can sign up to get daily emails about things that you might want to consult on. And so I've reached out to reporters that way. So I've been fortunate to collaborate, yes, with people from Livestrong and Weight Watchers and Health Digest, which is the health kind of outpost of Reader's Digest. I've been on some really great podcasts, Pursue Your Spark, and worked with Kristen Fitch and Bleep Bulimia podcast. Actually, it's Bleep Midlife Bulimia, which I love. So really bringing attention to eating disorders for women, in mid and later life. So I enjoy writing. I enjoy commenting. a lot of my perspective and how it differs is a lot of the perspective out there is just so extreme around nutrition. I think we can all agree, right? Like if you hear nutrition advice, it's usually about cutting something out or, you know, this thing is bad or this thing is good and you should eat it all the time. And something is wrong with you if you do this, you know, like a lot of nutrition advice is very extreme and very shaming. And I try to have, and I believe it would benefit everyone to have more of a moderate approach. And of course, you know, all things in moderation, right? Like is not a, an exciting, thing to share. And for emotional eaters in particular, who might feel out of control around food, all things in moderation feels, unbelievable. It feels like something that's unachievable and unattainable for them. They feel like they either do way too much or they have to restrict and not have anything. And so they end up on these cycles of doing that. And so I've really made it a part of my mission or part of my passion is sharing that moderation and how to get it. You know, if someone struggles with emotional eating, if they're feeling out of control around food, they might believe they can't be moderate and they have actual experiences to prove it. You know, if they're struggling with binging and things like that. But the reality is those behaviors aren't their inborn personality. Those behaviors aren't something that's wrong with them or their genetics or something that can't be overcome. Those behaviors are a result of hormones and, you know, a lot of diet culture things that they have learned. And so when they can unlearn and connect back to their body and balance those hormones, that behavior becomes a lot easier to avoid. So that's why I'm passionate about getting in some of these publications, collaborating, just to let people know if you're struggling, there is no shame. You know, you're doing it for a darn good reason. Emotional eating works. And, you know, the kind of the extremism is leading us all astray in a lot of ways.
I love that. And I mean, you know what, you said something. So I'm 51 and you said something to me and you work specifically with women 45 and older. Mm-hmm. And you said bulimia in like middle life. And yeah. I would have never, that thought would have never come into my mind that is that an issue or why is that an issue? And yet, as soon as you said it, I immediately knew, understood why. Because I am that age demographic and that situation demographic. And so that's fascinating because I would have never, you know, it's something I worry about in my teenage girls.
Yes.
Right? The preteen and teen, you worry about anorexia and bulimia and eating disorders and image and stuff. And then we hit middle age and so much shifts in our bodies that we don't have control over that I can completely understand why that would be a big deal.
Yeah, 100%. You know, and a lot of my clients who come to me who might be struggling with something like binging or even emotional eating, you know, maybe not quite to the level of binging, they've been struggling with it their entire life and they've had years where it's been good and years where it hasn't and tried all the different treatments and it has or hasn't worked. Or exactly like you say, something about menopause has made things just heightened and maybe made things worse with their eating, certainly body changes and, you know, trying to restrict and then binge as a result. But also I think what doesn't get spoken enough about is how stressful that time in life can be. Not only are the stress hormones upregulated because of the hormonal changes, but research shows, there's this great piece of research out of the Seattle area, actually, where I'm from, that shows that women in midlife, it's the most stressful time in a woman's life, that they're dealing with, you know, adult children, aging parents, you know, their jobs and like also worried about retirement, but it's far enough away that it's just a worry right now. And all of these things, relationship issues, that it tends to be one of the most stressful times in a woman's life. And on top of that, you know, her nervous system can upregulate. So certainly, binging, bulimia, any sort of eating issue can arise at this time in life. You'd asked me about the compassionate clarity call. Yeah. And so that's what I call my discovery call or my free consult call for people to figure out what the best next step is for them towards healing their emotional eating and whether or not I can help them. You know, if I can't, I'm always trying to refer them, help them figure out the best next step. But I call it compassionate clarity because that's just what I'm hoping to give people. Like, I'm just trying to be straightforward. This is what I want from you. Gosh, if I could add the word hope in there, but it just keeps getting longer and longer. You can't have a call with a 10 word name. But the idea being, I want people to walk away feeling more compassion for themselves because oftentimes these struggles with food lead to self-criticism and lead to, you know, self-hatred. And certainly the world's expectations on women can often make them feel like a failure. And so, compassion really meaning for self, for themselves to understand what's happening to them, why it's happening to them, and then clarity. Because I think oftentimes, I don't know if you've experienced this, but I mean, as a dietitian, I experience this analysis paralysis or information overwhelm where everyone and their brother has got an idea about how you need to solve your problem or what problem you actually have. And I hear from so many people that they just feel overwhelmed. Like they feel hopeless in their eating, like it'll never change because they've been struggling for so long or the struggle feels so big. And then even if they start to think about changing, they feel so overwhelmed because they know all the things they've tried before. Oftentimes they go back and try those same things, which, you know, I'll be honest with you, doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me because those things didn't work, but I understand the impulse, you know, it's comfortable. And so just having clarity about the best next step, I think is a way that I really want to serve my community or people who come into my world asking for my help.
Well, and we talked when we were pre-gaming that, you know, every entrepreneur bursts their business from their struggle as a direct result. And our goal is to make it faster, easier, more supported for other people. So compassionate clarity makes perfect sense. And I also feel like as a woman in this age demographic, no one's talking really. Okay, the thing with women just that drives me crazy is that why don't we talk more about periods, that you shouldn't be embarrassed buying tampons at the checkout, that every single woman that you ever pass by, young or old, has had the same issue, right? Like why don't we talk about that? Why don't we talk about what it's like, what sex is like, what to expect, what if it's not good, what about pregnancy and miscarriage and losing a child or difficulty raising parents? It's interesting that women to me a lot of the time seem to attack each other instead of banding together. And this is yet one more thing, menopause and all of those changes. I had never heard that it was one of the most difficult times that a woman goes through. No one until you has ever made that statement to me. And I thought, huh, that's interesting. Cause now I go back and think about my time pregnant, my time, like all the phases of your life.
Yeah.
Cause now all but one of my kids are adults and I have 12 grandkids and I'm postmenopausal at 51. So yeah, I mean, no, nobody ever says that. And maybe women should know that and be a little kinder to themselves. And yet also because it's so difficult and things change that you don't have control over, like your body changes a lot when you get pregnant, but you expect it to because you're pregnant.
Yeah.
There's not as much conversation circulating about the fact that menopause is the same, but it takes like 10 years. It drags out and there really isn't that much conversation around that. So I find that really fascinating just to start having that conversation, because even for me going through all of that, I'm like, really, it's one of the hardest times. I need to like think about that. And yeah, for my body, it's the hardest time. Yes, you are correct. Totally correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the things I'm really passionate about, and why, you know, if anyone's looking at me right now, the white elephant in the room is I'm not actually in middle age. I'm in my 30s. I have a toddler, you know, I'm not the demographic that I serve. And people will often ask, you know, why do you specifically work with women in middle age and up? And number one, I just... No shame, you know, no insult to younger people, but I just like these women better. They're my favorite people to work with. But on the other hand, you know, when you start a business, people are like, well, who do you like to work with? And all the people I thought of, right, were women in this age group. But on the other hand, I have been, you know, blessed to get some education in what happens in menopause. And similar to what you're saying, I was like, I never knew this. I've never heard this. I don't think anyone I've ever worked with who's in this age group knows this. And, you know, the more I start to work with women in this age group, the advice they're getting from their, you know, just kind of general practitioners is quite frankly awful and really misleading. I had a woman the other day who, you know, struggles with emotional eating, and she's having really bad hot flashes, and her doctor said, you should try the keto diet. And I'm like, no, that's really awful, awful advice for this particular woman, right? I'm not saying for everyone, but I'm saying for this particular woman, and emotional eaters in general, going on restrictive diets is just, it's not a recipe for success. It's a recipe for just feeling really awful. And so, yeah, the point here is I've seen there is not enough care for women in midlife to help them understand what's happening in their bodies, how it impacts them. You know, a lot of things that I will just mention as well, in case it's helpful for anyone listening, is mood, anxiety, depression, like kind of mood changes are also really common. And I think people know that there's to some degree, like in culture, like, oh, mom's going through menopause, whatever, watch out for her. But it's like the nervous system is just so much faster to activate during that menopausal transition. Hopefully it, you know, calms down and isn't the case after. But that's something that can be really crazy making and feel very uncomfortable and really impact your life. And you add that to just being a stressful time in general, it can really create struggle. And I just want to say, if anyone's out there struggling like that, you're not alone, nothing weird. I mean, it is weird, but nothing outside of the normal or freakish is happening to you. It can be a difficult time. And so getting support from people who understand the menopausal transition and can help you understand, can be very helpful and take away some of that feeling of isolation.
Not only that, but I have a great practitioner. I absolutely love her. She's wonderful and limited. And I'm fortunate that she's wonderful enough that instead of giving me advice or suggestions or recommendations that, like the keto diet in that specific situation, or even in general in menopause, I mean, instead of giving me bad advice, she let me know that I needed to seek out someone else and help me figure out how to find the right person. You don't have to have all of the answers. You have to know how to direct and find them. And that was the best thing she did. And then she's like, I want to hear all about it. I want to know what she told you to do. I want to know how your experience is. I want to know if this is somebody I can refer to other people. And we had the follow-up conversations. And so mm-hmm. I think it's important for everyone to know, not just in this situation, just because somebody is a doctor and is talking to you doesn't mean that they are maybe adept at this situation, especially like you said, with that person in particular. We don't fit into a box. And I learned that like 17 years ago when I was doing fitness competitions, my first trainer, you know, they give you a food plan. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize how bad I was feeling because it's insidious. It happens slowly over time. And I did a fitness competition and a guy in the audience came up to me and said, you don't have to switch and come to me for training, but I can tell you that your diet is off and it's going to get worse and you're going to crash. And well, first of all, yeah, I did hire him because, yeah. You know, but I mean, basically he saw me and knew I did not fit into the box I was being put on, and it was a disservice to me. And he let me know I was going to crash. And then the symptoms that I was kind of having, I went, oh, no, this is, yes, I am feeling this way. And I was putting it off or thinking it was from something else. Or, you know, we, especially women, tend to make a lot of excuses for ourselves and our health and put it on the back burner. And just because you're going to see somebody, I mean, it took me like 4 visits and asking a lot of questions and being my own advocate with a good practitioner to get to that place. So are you seeing the same sort of thing?
Certainly, being an advocate, you know, that was the word I was thinking of, actually, as you were talking, and then, you know, there you said it. I think that's don't be afraid to ask someone why they give you a certain recommendation. You know, have they used it with other people? What is their proof that this recommendation is going to work? You know, when I'm helping people around emotional eating, like I have my own personal experience and then the experience of over 70 women who I've helped walk through this healing journey. And so I can pull a lot of stories. And so that's what I look for from other people as well. Like, you know, okay, you're saying keto for hot flashes. Have you seen that work? What's your proof? And, you know, I went back and I Googled and there was like one study, you know, a short little study, and that's probably where they got it from. It wasn't completely pulled out of thin air. But again, like knowing what I know about emotional eating is not the appropriate, solution for this woman. And so, yes, being your own advocate, asking for evidence that it's worked for people like you. You know, the other thing is I think our system, the systems that we live in, the medical system, doesn't really value a healthy relationship with food. It doesn't value being able to make choices that you enjoy and being able to choose healthy foods in a way that like feels good to you mentally, right? Like it's all about the outcomes. It's all about maybe the BMI or the hot flashes, right? Like it's these outcomes rather than getting outcomes maybe, but in a way that also honors the fact that you have a whole history, you know, as women, in their, you know, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th decade, the women I work with have a lot of baggage around food. They've often been put on diets at a young age, you know, as young as 8, 9, 12. I have women who tell me their doctors, overheard their doctors telling their mom when they were children that to help control weight, they should make her, the child, feel self-conscious about her weight, you know, as much as possible. And for those of us who know anything about eating disorders or having a healthy relationship with food, it's like you can't help but feel that one in the gut because it's sad to me that would be the advice, you know, and that was the advice of medical practitioners in that time, you know, generally. And so the point I'm trying to make here is, our relationship with food, again, like it's a piece of nuance. It's a piece of like, it's not going to be good for people who struggle with emotional eating to try to be extreme because of, you know, the history and how that can trigger going back to these more potentially disordered patterns like binging, emotional eating, these kinds of things.
Yeah. It's so loaded, isn't it?
It is. It's a loaded, loaded topic.
Yeah. And I never believed in, personally, I never believed in that you could never eat something or you had to eliminate anything, but that if it is in moderation, you should be able to have what you want, you know, to some degree. We're going to switch gears.
Okay.
But first, on the page you have to, which page? It's the Stress Less Weight Mastery. Mm-hmm. So, and you're adorable. And at the bottom, you say, these are things about you. I love my coffee, but not black. I'm a smidge of oat milk kind of gal. I'm happiest ambling up a mountain with my husband and toddler. So you're a mom. Mm-hmm. And I spend as much money at farmers markets as some women spend at shoe sales. Amen to that, my sister. and I also, I appreciate that you address the fact that you're younger than I am, and yet you're working with women my age. And I don't feel like that should be a big deal at all. It's interesting that I don't know what the percentage is, but in my opinion, it seems like more OBGYNs are men and they've never once been pregnant or had a period.
I've noticed that myself.
I'm just saying. I mean, so like the fact that you're not at that age, it's great preventative medicine for you.
For me, for sure. Yeah.
For sure. And you know, we can have expertise in an area that we don't struggle with, but that we have struggled with, but put it in a demographic that has the greatest need that fulfills our hearts too. And so I'm not a teenager anymore, but I've worked with a lot of teenagers, and that doesn't mean that you have to be one to get it. Mm-hmm. So I want to address that and like nullify that situation, but also I love the little things about you. So what I want to do now is just go back in time in your journey and your story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So I was born in the 80s. I'm a Pacific Northwest girl. So born and raised here outside of Seattle. And, I am the oldest, born to two oldest children. And I was reportedly a very headstrong child, which, you know, comes back at me through now my toddler. I have to say, I'm glad to be helping mold future generations of strong, capable women, but wow, is that difficult some days? And for me, you know, both, I can see now how both of my parents come from systems of intergenerational trauma, you know, poverty, teen pregnancies for, you know, generations back, and how that kind of molded who they were as young parents to me then, in both in their early 20s. And you know, it's always hindsight, right? But both of my parents were emotional eaters. I can remember my dad would go to the store in the evening. It's so funny. I can't imagine now leaving the house, you know, leaving my warm house on a cold night to like go get candy for my family. I just would be like, no, you guys don't need it. I don't need it. Like, we're not doing this. But he would go out and buy candy for the family. He'd come back. I have two younger sisters and my mom, and you know, my mom would have a payday bar. We would have the Hershey's bars or those white chocolate Hershey's bars with little bits of that kind of Oreo cookie in it. If anyone knows what I'm talking about. I mean, pure sugar. I've become a bit of a chocolate snob now, to the point where like, I would never eat that stuff. But, but back then, you know, that was normal. Mom had a hard day at work, so dad goes out and buys payday bars. My mom has stories of stopping at convenience stores and buying those ice cream drumsticks when she was pregnant with me after a hard day, you know? So there's like family lore around emotional eating, good cooks. You know, my great grandma was, supposedly I'd never met her, an amazing cook. And, you know, there's kind of this family lore around food. And I didn't see that was an issue for me though, until I was in grad school, studying nutrition of all things, and anxiety was really high. But the other thing going on is, you know, growing up, as my mom was working through the things that were difficult for her, she struggled with some anger and stress. And my dad ended up with some debilitating sleep apnea. And you know, that was a chronic illness for him. He was unable to work for many years, and he ended up being a stay-at-home dad, but like not from a, you know, a picture that we think of stay-at-home dads today, where they're like on top of it and doing everything, from a picture of being disabled in that way and not able to care for everything. And so I became the oldest. My sisters were 7 and 9 years younger than me. And I saw myself as another mom to them. And trying to keep the peace between my parents, I became very good at reading the room, you know, and many people who have struggled in their childhood have that hypervigilance of, you know, being able to know what's going on at all times. And I can see how that really benefits me now, because I do telephone coaching, and I joke sometimes where there can be a silence and I can be like, why are you making that face? You know, I can't see them, right? But I know, like, I'd have this deep connection to people and their moods and how they're feeling, which has benefited me in my career. But of course, that was generated growing up in that environment, being the oldest, trying to protect my siblings from, you know, whatever may come. And so, of course, you know, all of that information about how my childhood impacted me now, honestly, is a lot of the work I've been doing in the past few years. You know, this is a lot of journaling. Like, I didn't know this when I first started helping people heal from emotional eating. And what that means to me, and I see it come out with my clients as well, is that emotional eating really is the tip of the iceberg. In the sense that there is a lot more below the surface that we often have to work through. And so, you know, back to grad school, I was studying nutrition, optimal nutrition. I really was in love with food, and I thought it was so cool how food can benefit us and help us. And yet I also, again, hindsight's 2020, kind of had almost an orthorexic or like just an unhealthy relationship with food, and that believing that whatever, if I felt bad, I'd be like, well, what did I eat? You know, or if I suffered some ill consequence in life, well, what did I eat or what did I not eat? Or, you know, how do I need to control my food to better control life? And, you know, I was in a culture at the time that was very like wellness driven and prevention driven and, you know, be the best, do the best, never get sniffles, like this kind of stuff. And I learned a lot. It was a great time in life, except for, I am type A. I call myself a recovering, perfectionist, but really for me, doing the best and being the best was part of my self-identity. And I did not know how to like do something at a B or lower. So I was stressed to the point of intense panic attacks. I remember, you know, my husband and I will never forget this. At one point during the second year of school, that really came to a head for me. I was so exhausted, you know, studying all the time, so worried about grades, using food. I would go and get a bar of artisanal dark chocolate, Theo's, if anyone's from the Pacific Northwest knows. Yep. Yes, yep. The yep. Absolute best.
The absolute best.
100%. Still my favorite. Yeah. Yes, me too. Gone are the days of Hershey's. We've moved up in the world.
100%. I'm with you on the snob. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
Okay, so you would get these.
I would get these just about daily. That was one of the ways I coped, but it didn't work. Obviously it did not work. I wasn't dealing with the stress, dealing with my feelings, or why I was feeling that way. I was using food. And so I'd feel better in the moment, but it ultimately led to a very severe panic attack for me that literally happened in the dead of night, which is just so, I mean, it's so not funny to me, but it makes sense to me. Like, I was ignoring my physical reality, ignoring my feelings so much that for my body to get my attention, it woke me up in the middle of the night. And here's how I woke up. I actually woke up in the middle of my bedroom, not on my bed. I'd somehow gotten out of bed and was standing in the middle of the room. I've never sleepwalked. Nothing like this has ever happened to me before. And I was just screaming bloody murder. Can you imagine my poor husband waking up this way? Wow. A screaming bloody murder. I woke up, right, standing in the middle of the room, screaming, which is a very scary feeling, but I had so much adrenaline, so much of that cortisol coursing through my veins in that moment that I felt like I was running from a murderer, you know? And so then taking a couple minutes, and then my husband tries to grab me to calm me down, and that's like, even worse, right? And so just, I mean, the panic of all panics, honestly. And so calm down. I'm like, I need to get some help. I went to our school counselor and she shamed me. She's like, I don't know what's wrong with all of you dietetic students being so da 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 da. Here's a workbook. I can't really help you. Like, she's like, you could probably go get some medication, but I don't really know. Like, it was the absolute worst experience ever, you know? And honestly, I can really relate because oftentimes I will refer people to counseling, and now I know, having, you know, had good experiences with counselors at this point in my life, like keep trying. To anyone out there who's like, I tried that and they sucked, or they told me this thing I didn't like, or, you know, whatever, like keep trying, because yeah, that was awful. It was awful, awful, experience. It was not helpful. So I honestly just continued on. I continued on emotional eating. I continued on having this anxiety. I graduated. I became a registered dietitian. I started working in the field, really enjoyed the work I was doing and was not so stressed because I, you know, was out of school and on to the next thing. And so things kind of calmed down for me for a while, but they picked back up again after the birth of my daughter. And something about becoming a mom, and I know a lot of women can relate to this, some switch was flipped in me to where I just all of a sudden believed I deserved zero self-care, that I deserved no care, and I need to devote all of my energy for caring, you know, keeping this child alive. It's so interesting because, you know, I've been through individual counseling, we've been through marriage counseling, and had to like look back at that time on our lives and like really figure out how were we feeling, what happened, you know? And at the time, I would have told you I was feeling fine because I wasn't dealing with my feelings. I turned again to food. This time it was Ritz crackers and the white aged Tillamook cheese. Also good stuff to get me through, zero self-care, right? I had put on a lot of weight as well. About 50 pounds during pregnancy. It was a very difficult pregnancy. I had a very difficult infant. You know, at each stage in life, people keep going, oh, if you have a hard pregnancy, you're gonna have an easy baby. Oh, if you have a hard baby, you're gonna have an easy toddler. That's never been true for me.
Yeah, well, I would say wives' tales are just that for the most part. Like, what gender are you having when you're pregnant? Like, you already started out with a 50% chance of being right.
Right, you exactly. Know, like, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. So are you working full time at this point? You're still working?
So I was on maternity leave for 6 months. I was back at my company for 2.5 days, and it was a startup and it closed. So I lost my job 2.5 days in, 2 weeks severance pay. We had just bought a house. We're thinking things are so stable in our lives. We had bought a house while I was on maternity leave and started renovating it. It was an insane time. It was really akin to grad school, where stress upon stress started coming up for me. I was, you know, now no self-care, now using food to cope. And I ended up in a lot of physical pain, and that was the catalyst for me to figure this out. I was in a lot of physical pain. Holding my daughter was uncomfortable. I said, like, I need to figure this out. I know the food I'm eating, the Ritz crackers and the cheese, right? Like, as a dietitian, I know that's not helping. And I don't know what's going on. So I started seeing a naturopath, and I got diagnosed with some autoimmune issues that were causing that physical pain, and my digestion and what I was eating was impacting it as well. And so I had to come to terms with that and even restrict a little bit, even though I don't like restricting, because I had done so much of it back in grad school and just ended up on that road of restricting and binging, basically. And binging for me was like, oh, I'll go buy some donuts to reward myself for finals. And then, you know, that box I was going to share with everyone is gone in a day. And so I was at this point where I had to figure something out, and I knew that I didn't want to, I wanted to really develop and then preserve a healthy relationship with food. At the time, I saw my relationship as relatively healthy, which is funny because it wasn't, but I was comparing it to people with like active diagnosable eating disorders and going, well, at least I'm not there. Right. And so I knew I had to figure it out. And the journey I went on was really a journey of self-discovery. It was a journey of unlearning a lot of what I had learned, getting my master's in nutrition, a lot of what it means to be kind to yourself in regards to your relationship with food and how important self-compassion is. And then understanding how my background and my childhood and my upbringing actually it was impacting the choices with food I was making. And I started to see a lot of similarities in the women I was working with as well. And so, you know, holding all of that the questions that I started to ask myself are like, how can we love ourselves well and develop these relationships with food that are helpful? And I started to see how the nervous system, you know, I've talked a lot about stress already, and stress was a big catalyst for me, but that nervous system, even if you don't feel psychological stress, even if you're not aware of your stress, because like me, you're using food to numb it, so you maybe aren't even feeling it. That's a big, big piece. And self-compassion is a big piece in terms of what we're thinking and how we're caring for ourselves, because self-criticism, beating ourselves up for making these choices, only leads to more eating. And then that extremism, you know, one thing that is obvious, I think the size of our bodies is very connected to what we eat. And so for me, as I was gaining weight, I noticed I would go out in public, you know, I'd be at church even. I have a very strong memory of being at church and looking around and like all these other moms are so much skinnier, you know, than I am. And on Zoom, I look like I'm just like a normal weight or even more petite person because I carry all of my weight in my hips and my rear end, to be honest. And so I do have a larger body compared to some of these other people, and really feeling that self-consciousness and asking myself, like, is this self-consciousness? Because for me, I'm doing the healthy things, you know, is this self-consciousness a reason for me to restrict and change and jeopardize my relationship with food so that I can be smaller, you know, to kind of fit into what other people want from me? And so really diving into, where does our body image come from? Where does my body image come from? How do I want to feel about that? And recognizing that anytime you live in a larger body, whether you accept yourself or not, there's probably going to be some amount of pain, emotional pain involved in that, which is experienced the same as physical pain in our brain, because society is fat phobic and society has weight stigma. And, you know, people go, oh, you know, you're a dietitian, like, God, you don't look like you eat well. And so carrying that forward too, and carrying that into my work, and just, I think for me, the biggest thing has been holding space, because what I was doing with food was avoiding feeling. And so learning to feel, holding space to feel, and then holding space for all of the mess that is involved with eating, body image. You know, what also comes up that people never expect is now boundaries and people pleasing. And it's like, well, they want me to eat this, you know, at the social function, and I don't want to eat it, or I, you know, that's not the best choice for me. You know, feeling like you need to people please, and feeling like you can't say no. And care for yourself. Because what happens with emotional eating is if you're not caring for yourself, your body needs some outlet for those emotions. And it may end up using food to care for those emotions. So the moral of this story, I've really, you know, tried to share the more poignant pieces of my story. But I discovered that my nervous system was having a big impact. My lack of self-care was having a big impact. The way I was thinking about myself in a non-compassionate manner was having a big impact. And then there's a lot of systemic things that are outside of my control, like, you know, weight stigma and fat phobia and people's obsession with BMI and kind of the extremism that is in our culture around food and body. And so that is, you know, something I have to hold space for, the uncomfortable feelings that that elicits, and then do my best to fight what I believe are systems of oppression, because, you know, I want it to be better for my daughter's generation, and I want women to not be oppressed by diet culture and everything that goes with it.
It's so hard. I know, like with my teenagers, for example, there was a video. It was awesome. There were actually two, and one was a woman who sat down for a photo shoot. They took a picture of her, and then you watched them change the picture, yeah. Right? And so I know for my girls, when they were preteens and teens, really watching that, like, that, isn't that a beautiful picture? I wonder what it started out as. There was one that started out as a piece of pizza.
No way.
You have to look it up.
I will. Starts I'm writing off as that
a,
down.
As a piece of pizza, right? Mm-hmm. And the thing is that 100% of all of the photos that we see online are not just a little bit changed. And if it's hard for your brain to even see the before and after without watching it happen, like, holy cow. And when sometimes they make a mistake where the waist is a little off.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and that's, you need to be super realistic about what you're seeing. You need to come to terms with what you're seeing is not what people look like. Jamie Lee Fox did a, is that her name? Why does that sound wrong to me now? Anyway, Jamie Lee Curtis, maybe?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Whew, sorry, my brain. Okay. Jamie Lee Curtis did a spread in a magazine years ago. And they wanted to do a glamour shoot with her. And she said, yes, only if you show up and you take pictures of me before and during. So she was wearing like boy shorts and a tank top, no makeup on, like hanging out. And again, she didn't look bad at all. And she wanted her photos completely unedited, except for that last glamour shot. And her whole goal was to show that here's this glamour shot. And she's like, I look amazing. I feel amazing. I love what I see in this picture. It took 7 people 5 hours for me to look that way. So unless you have 7 people in 5 hours every day to get you ready, and then it's about the right positioning of your body and the right lighting. I had like headshots taken, and I'm really big into no editing. And I told the photographer here in Reno, like, I don't want you to edit anything out. And he showed me the pictures and I said, you had to have edited them. And he's like, no, that's what you really look like. And first of all, good lesson, because we don't give ourselves nearly enough credit for the good stuff. We are mm-hmm. so critical on the bad stuff.
Yeah.
And I said, so what did you do in the process so that I looked like the best version of myself? And he said, lighting. And I said, would you like a job following me around with lights? You know, like, it really is a lot about that. And even my 12-year-old daughter wants apps for photos. And I'm like, any photo that is editing what you really look like is never going to be allowed. You're not filtering who you really are. That is like that's like living an alternative universe of what you wish your life was like and why. I think also you made comments about comparing yourself to other people. Often we don't realize, and it may not be specifically with a number on the scale with your weight issue, but you are someone's after picture.
Certainly.
So your journey is relative, and I like to only compare myself against myself because that's fair. And also that for someone else in their struggle, I'm the after picture. It may not be in weight. It may be in something else. It may be in confidence or articulation, but we're really, really not very kind to ourselves at all. And we look forward at what we want ideally, but we don't often take a moment, and I do this a lot in coaching, to look back at where we've come from. Mm-hmm. We don't take a moment to look back at how much we have achieved. You know, I don't know about you, Cassie, but I have 100% success rate of getting through bad days.
I love that.
100% success. That doesn't mean it ended up being a good day. It doesn't mean things were resolved on that day. It doesn't mean I handled it particularly well. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that I don't make mistakes, but I have 100% success rate of getting through every bad situation I've ever been in. And so has everyone else. But we don't often, especially as women, especially when we become mothers, like you pointed out, to just pat ourselves on the back for a job well done in an area.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Wow. And I know you see that with your clients too, because like you said, and self-care is such an overused word. I don't know what we should use instead, but right. It seems like it self-care is going above and beyond what's normal, like showering.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And sometimes when we're new moms or when we are moms,
yeah,
showering is like a super big accomplishment.
Yeah.
So we need to applaud the fact that if it was a shower or making your bed or like not hitting snooze 6 times, that we need to do the little wins. The little wins are super important.
Yeah.
And that self-care shouldn't be a pedicure annually. Mm-hmm. It should be just, there should be things that are normal to taking your care of yourself on a day-to-day basis that aren't considered quote self-care. They're just you living your life and doing the minimum. And yet we've labeled them as going above and beyond, and they're not. So we're super hard on ourselves for just getting in an extra long shower, for goodness sake, and how that's now on our bucket list of self-care to-dos. So I really think you do a lot with mindset with women who are struggling with that self-esteem and mindset around eating. But don't you see, I mean, I just see how much it spreads out into you becoming a mom and that self-care piece, and how one thing ties to another thing, ties to another thing, ties to another thing. And just, geez, guys, congratulate yourselves from the wins that you're having and how that you have 100% success rate of getting through a bad day. Yeah. And yes, then needing to address the fact that it could be an emotional eating or a disorder, or yes, there can be bigger things to play at play, but it's so sad that women are so hard and that we don't just take care of ourselves because we should.
Yeah. You know, I have a couple thoughts. I really love the things that you've brought up. And I've been taking little notes to myself in case anyone's like, why does she have a pen in her hand all of a sudden? The thing that I often come up against is this all or nothing thinking. I've talked about the extremism and this black and white, either I'm a success or a failure. And I think that's what you're getting to, in that as we're thinking about our success or lack thereof, or what we're doing, or how we're comparing, you know, to others or ourselves or whoever, like, it's this, the measuring stick is all or nothing. And of course, that's unbelievably unfair. And it's not real life, because you're not either a success or a failure. And so exactly like you're saying, a lot of what I do with my clients is like, okay, share with me your partial success, share with me your little win. You know, what is the thing I was sharing with my community the other day? Like, I started a 60-minute yoga video. I got 20 minutes into it, and then I went and took a nap. It was a really hard day. Number one, just doing the yoga was, you know, just trying was a win that day. I'm counting my 1/3 of a yoga practice as a win, but actually even more, I'm counting my connection to what my body really needed, which was going and laying down, a win. And that kind of gets to, you know, I agree with you. I think the word self-care, it's become another measurement of that people can feel ashamed, you know, about their lack of measuring up. But I think what it really is, what self-care really is, like what we're actually trying to say, is something along the lines of trusting yourself, like a self-trust and a connection to your body, to where you can listen and respond to what you need, where you're checking in, you're prioritizing that internal communication, and then prioritizing, you know, doing the things you need to do in response to that oral, that internal communication. And so really that is at its base, it is for you to do that effectively, you have to believe that you are worthy of love and care, just based on who you are, you know, not related to what you do for other people, not related to, and this was for me, this is what I found for myself. And I remember the moment where I'm like, no, I'm not, like, I am valuable based on what I, keeping my daughter alive, or I am valuable based on, you know, if I measure up to these set of, you know, kind of measuring sticks that I've made for myself. If I do this, this, and this, right? Which I never did. I never did any of it. So I was always a failure in that respect. I was basing my value and worth on what I was doing for other people and how other people perceived me, rather than just the fact that I am a child of God and I am worthy of love. and connection and care, just who I am. And it wasn't until I was able to shift that belief. It wasn't until I saw that that's how I was operating. And it wasn't a quick shift. It was like, I had to see that that's what I was operating from. And then just kind of keep living from that place, and talk about it with people and notice what I was doing and question, am I operating out of believing that I'm worthy of love when I do this thing for other people? Or am I operating out of, why am I doing this thing? And eventually, the switch flipped after sitting in the discomfort of feeling that way. Like really, that's what it was about for me, is feeling the feeling, sitting in the discomfort of feeling that I was like, oh, no, okay, I am worthy of love and connection. And, I always get on a soapbox about that old airplane mask analogy, where people are like, oh, self-care, you need to put your own mask on before you, put the mask on other people. And the thing I hate about that is I think it underscores, it continues to validate this idea that the only reason you would save a woman's life is so that she can then save the lives of people around her on a plane. And of course, if I'm on a plane, I'm putting my daughter's mask on first. Like, let's all just be honest, whether or not it's good, right? Like, I will save her life first every time. Whether or not that is the thing to do and the best thing for me. But I think what we need to remember is you are worthy of putting that mask on yourself. I'm worthy of putting that mask on myself, even if I don't save anyone else. Let's say your kids and family aren't on the plane with you. Even if you don't save anyone else, you are worthy of putting that mask on and saving, just as you are.
Tell me about, so you're having these issues with food, you're realizing it because you're working in it. So yeah. It's got to be like in your face all the time, which is not making this easier for you.
Right.
You're navigating because they're not teaching you in school the emotional breakdown that you're possibly going to have when you're working
Of course not. No.
You recognize it and you were good about, we've used the word advocating before. You had gone to a therapist, it hadn't gone well, but you've said already that you continue to try. So you're finding the ways, and it can be something outside of talk therapy also, but you're finding the ways to get your emotional health and well-being there. I know from your story, there was another piece of this. I know somewhere in this journey, so you lost your job, you're doing renovations, you're realizing that there's this whole emotional aspect to being a dietitian that they're not teaching. And I know at some point things switched for you too, to a different, I don't know how to say this right, but escape. Or, okay, I know it'll make sense to you. Can you take us through that period in your life, because you learned to get healthy and be healthy and then help other women advocate for themselves and be part of the missing piece of the puzzle as a dietitian, which is phenomenal. So bridge that gap for me.
Yeah. So tell me if this isn't what you were getting at, because I'm not 100% sure, but the escape, the thing that comes up for me with escape is, I love to read cozy murder mysteries. Yeah.
Yep.
And once I started to feel my emotions a little bit more and sit with them a little bit more, really, once I started to really calm my nervous system as well. And for me, it was, making sure I'm sleeping well, making sure I'm eating regularly throughout the day. Like, there are some pretty simple things you can do to make a big impact there. I got to a place where I wasn't in crisis anymore. And so when I wasn't in crisis, in that crisis mode, I found I wasn't going to food as much. And so I kind of thought, great, like, this is done. I've solved this. It's no longer a problem for me. It's over. And, now I'm going to go help other people. And I did start to help people with emotional eating in that place. And they were helped, as well. But what I noticed eventually was I started reading these cozy murder mysteries a lot. And I would even read them at the dinner table with my family. And I didn't like that I was doing it. It was like this unspoken thing in my, you know, in my family, no one was like, why are you reading? Because it was clear, like, it's exhausting going through the day and then having a toddler and like, I'm just really tired and I feel like I can't engage with you. And so this is like my escape. And really what I discovered, and I think people do this in a lot of ways, you know, maybe TV or, you know, your phone or reading or whatever, I was using these books to numb rather than using food. And so then for me, it's like, okay, why am I using these foods to numb rather than, you know, why am I using these tools to numb? Why do I have to numb? And, you know, it was from there, just a deeper level, of diving into what was going on. How had my past affected how I was feeling in the moment? You know, how there's a pandemic going on. How am I dealing with that? And what I noticed, what I really learned about myself through that experience was accepting. So it's not so much feeling, like once I've kind of identified that something's going on, if I feel bad or whatever, fine, like I will allow myself to feel it. But the part that often gets messed up for me that leads to wanting to numb and wanting to get away is accepting that I'm even feeling a certain way. So I recently shared on my blog a story of a Friday where my business mentor, who I like love to death, she's someone who I've worked with after working with someone else, and that relationship ended very poorly. And it was honestly traumatic for me, like, you know, little T trauma, but like, yeah, it was hard. It was a really hard, you know, mentor breakup. And so she's kind of my person who feels more safe. And she made me mad. She offended me and I was mad at her, but I didn't want to be mad at her. Right. Like, I love her. Like I do. I love her as a person. I sent her a Christmas card. Like, this lady, I have so much affection for her in my heart. But she hurt my feelings and she made me mad and I didn't want to feel that way. And so I just was in a funk. I remember telling my husband that day, I feel like I'm in a funk today. You know, when you're just in a funk and you don't quite know why. And, you know, I like this story because I think it also gives people an understanding of what the healing journey is like, that it really is a journey. If anyone ever tells you like, oh, you will solve your emotional eating and you'll never do it again, I don't believe that is, again, that's extreme, you know, so like, I'm not for that, but like, I don't think that's true. I recently saw someone who had like end emotional eating in 30 days. Like, if you can end your emotional eating in 30 days, you weren't actually an emotional eater or like someone who really had a problem with it. You just maybe had a breakup and like, you feel better after it, you know, whatever. Right. So the example I'm sharing is one that it looks like for when someone has healed their emotional eating, like that struggle can still come up and it just brings me to deeper layers of understanding. And so, that night I was still in a funk. I'm watching Netflix. And my daughter was gone to bed. My husband maybe went to bed too. I'm sitting there watching Netflix. And I just had, and for anyone who struggled with emotional eating, they understand, the most extreme, like primal craving where I'm like, give me, you know, something sugary and give it to me right now. And I think this is really the feeling that people describe as addiction, even like just where you feel like you are not in control of what you're about to do. And there's no willpower that's going to stand up to it. And so I go rooting around in the cupboard, you know, and I see we have marshmallows and Cheerios. And so I make a mug Rice Krispie with Cheerios and marshmallows and I eat that. And I felt guilty about it because I knew exactly what I was doing, right? I know the tools to use, but the truth of the matter is like those, you can't, that's holding myself to too high of an expectation to believe that I'm not going to need time to just process and feel and be kind of crappy on the way to figuring out what's going on. You know, fast forward the next day. And I think too, the fact that I just had one and kind of moved on is also evidence there of growth, because in the past, man, I would have kept going. So the next day was just too busy. It was a family day. Like I never thought about the problem, right? Thank God for busy families. And then on Sunday, I had a little more time to process. I had a little more space. I was still feeling bad. Now I'm feeling bad about the eating Friday night, which is also a sign for me, because I normally don't have guilt around eating. And so I told my husband, look, I need some space. Like keep our daughter out. Don't even let her come knock on the door. Like I need space, you know? And I sat and I journaled and I figured out through my journaling that I was actually mad and I wasn't accepting the fact that I was mad and that I was hurt. And then from there, I still felt bad. And so I did a technique that I've learned from Dr. Kristen Neff, and she's a self-compassion researcher, called soften, soothe, allow. And you can type those words into Google and or YouTube and get a nice video where you visualize in your body where you're feeling the feeling. You soften it in your mind. You soothe yourself by speaking kind words, you know, and that can feel so weird for people. Like it can feel so hocus pocus and woo woo and weird, but like, that's really important because we have to counteract the negative stuff. And then allow, just allowing that feeling to be there, you know, and that didn't magically take the discomfort away, but it did soften it. It did make me feel like, okay, I can go on with this day. I can show up for my family from this not fully optimal place. Like I'm still feeling upset. I wish this hadn't happened, and get like, I can hold space for it now and really just allow the feeling to be there, even though I don't want it to. So for me, once I realized, and this going back to these cozy murder mysteries, once I realized that my struggle was really in allowing me to feel, you know, again, that noticing I'm escaping in other ways just took me deeper into healing, although it was painful to get there, as often is the case. Then I could see, okay, what's really going on is I need to allow, accept, give permission for these feelings I don't want to have, and feel them and hold space for them. And that is not an easy thing to do. And yet, like I have found that it is the way towards fullness and living a life I want to live, because now I'm not always 100% present, but I'm a lot more present for my family and these relationships that are of the utmost importance to me than I was in the past.
I love how connected, like everything's connected.
It too. Is.
It's not just like, oh, I have this, you know, I trigger and I have this eating issue where I want sugar and it's emotional. Well, it crosses over into so many other parts. And I love how aware you are. This is the other thing. Earlier, you mentioned that you just made changes to your homepage. As coaches, dietitians, you know, as professionals helping other people, we've come from a struggle 100% of the time. We've come from a struggle. And we want to make it faster, easier, and more supportive for other people, but there's not a destination. It is a continuing journey. I work with NLP, and I can work with someone and get rid of their biggest limiting belief. Well, then why do these other limiting beliefs bubble to the surface? Because you've gotten that biggest roadblock out of the way. Mm-hmm. To allow that other stuff to bubble up. So you get rid of those five. Why do three more bubble up? Because we're never done.
Yeah.
We're not perfect. We're not going to achieve perfection. And so that's why our websites change. Sometimes how we work with clients or what we do or who our demographic is, all of that is so fluid. And that, you know, anyone who's a parent will get this, right? And I didn't get this until I was a parent about my mom. It made me feel more grace towards her situation, is that we're continuing to attempt to live our own story while creating the story for our children. And that is often at odds with each other. It's really difficult to continue our healing and our own story and not have that sometimes cross over with our kids in a way that's not positive. And it's really hard. We want to be great parents and we want to do a better job than our parents. And even when we do that and we're putting 100% in every day, some days 100% looks like we're knocking it out of the park, and other days 100% looks like a fraction. Based on so many things. And so there's so much grace we need to give yourself. I love that introspect where we don't like feeling the way we're feeling. So we'll do anything to not have to look that in the mirror, right? Mm-hmm. And to get through that. So I love that. I love how open you are about, yes, you have letters after your name, and you have all of this healing and self-help that you've already done. And yet, and you can coach people beautifully who have phenomenal results, which I've read all about. And yet while that's happening, you're just like a parent, you're still creating mm-hmm. your own story and living your own journey. And that's why things sort of shift with entrepreneurs, because when our story shifts, it changes how we work with who we work with and how we process our own stuff and help other people's process. It is a continuation of that journey. So I love that you shared that. You're all a human being, essentially. Mm-hmm. Cassie, thank you so much. I want to go back to the website. What is the easiest way for people to find you? And I think I kind of want to wrap up, and you can pick how you want to share this, because I don't like putting people on the spot, but it can be either like the number one thing people come to you with, or the one thing you would have told your younger self, that sort of thing, or your number one piece of advice when people are like, yes, I want help. And whether it's with you, which I really want people to look into that with emotional eating. I want them to know how to get in touch with you and be able to work with you easily. Mm-hmm. And yet, if there's some resistance in that, what's the one thing you would say or teach, or and you can pick it in any way you want.
Yeah. Okay. So first I'll share how people can get in touch with me. I have a guide that I am so passionate about. It's called You're Done Dieting, But Still Want to Heal Emotional Eating. And I share that for free. And it is a roadmap that shows people what it takes to get from point A to point B. And I talk about how, you know, emotional eating is a journey. You're never like fully there. But how to get it so that your emotional eating becomes a check engine light rather than something that knocks you off the rails and makes you feel really impacts your quality of life. And so I can help you get there with this guide that shows you exactly what it's going to take, talking about caring for your nervous system, how to become more self-compassionate. And it gives you the first couple steps to take so that you can get some momentum. And if that works for you, if the information is compelling, you can book that compassionate clarity call at cassiechristopher.net as well to find out from me how I specifically can help you, or if I can't, what it's going to take and what the best next step is. So cassiechristopher.net/free for that guide. You're done dieting, but still want to heal emotional eating, or you're welcome at cassiechristopher.net. You could just book a call with me if you're wanting some support. What I would say to someone who's like, okay, I have this problem. I'm struggling with emotional eating. I don't feel good in my body. I know that my relationship with food is, you know, causing me to obsess and giving me anxiety and really impacting that quality of life to the point where it's something that you want to address. If you're like the people I've worked with, you probably feel a little bit hopeless, very frustrated, very discouraged, because you've tried all the things. You've tried all the diets. You've tried, you know, following the advice. My favorite advice is just don't do that. my favorite worst advice, by the way. You've tried all the bad advice, right? And none of it has worked. And so you get to a place where you feel discouraged, you feel hopeless. And so what I want to say is every time you feel that way, every time you feel fear, like that is normal. And to heal emotional eating, it actually takes so much courage. It takes so much bravery. You know, you're hearing my story, and I'll be honest with you, my story was extremely painful. I'm still exhausted, you know, on top of living in a pandemic and being a small business owner and you know, everything else. I'm exhausted by this growth. And yet I wouldn't change it for the world. I am I'm a happier person. I'm a more connected person. I'm a more loving person. I'm proud of who I am and the work I do because of this difficulty I went through. And so, you know, hearing someone's story and how hard it is, I think it almost makes you more brave and more courageous for even thinking about it. So if you're like, I'm scared, I want to say, yeah, that's normal. And courage is doing it anyway. And you're courageous too.
Cassie, thank you so much for being on and sharing your story. I really appreciate you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.